song. Is it?
Hello and welcome to Whose Song Is It Anyway? A podcast with me, Dr. Hayley Bosher, co-hosted with Jules O'Riordan.
Hello, I'm Dr. Hayley Bosher. I'm a senior lecturer in intellectual property law at Brunel University, London, and I research mainly copyright in the music industry.
My name's Jules O'Riordan, aka Judge Jules. I am a specialist music lawyer, a partner at Sound Advice in London, alongside being a long-standing DJ and various other things within the music business.
Hey, I'm Steve Tempest, aka DJ SKT. I'm a DJ, producer, and a radio host.
Well, thanks for joining us, Steve. It's really nice to have you on the podcast. So, one of the things I thought would be really interesting to talk about today, because obviously for our audience, we're really focusing on copyright, but from a real music perspective. And although you might not know the ins and outs of copyright law, you've definitely had to deal with copyright protected material when you're making your work and producing songs and stuff. So first of all, I just want to ask, like, what is your perception of copyright? Like, do you see it as something that's like a barrier to creativity, or like, have you come up against problems with that? Or do you find it like confusing, or like, what, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Like, what is your perception of copyright?
I think copyright generally is a good thing. A lot of the time I'll use samples or works, especially from, could be like the 70s, 80s, 90s, and that can influence my own music, or sometimes I can find elements in other people's production that can kind of allow me to be able to create something. And copyright is often one of those issues you kind of have to tread carefully around or be very careful with. But generally, I think it's a good thing, you know?
So for you, when you're like using samples of other people's music, do you find that it's easy to do that, or have you come across like challenges in terms of like clearing rights and things like that?
I had a record a couple of years ago, I think it was 2016, that sampled Bell Biv DeVoe, Poison, and I kind of ended up giving it to a few DJs and it just went absolutely crazy. It was like Animax hottest record in the world on Radio 1. And then suddenly all the labels like jumped in like, hey, we want to sign this. And in the end, no one could get it signed because we just, for some reason, due to the copyright issues, the record just didn't go ahead and we could never, we never were able to get a new version done that everyone was kind of cool with. Sorry, what was the question again?
Well, just that, exactly that, like, yeah.
I did.
Well, I think you answered it really, really well, actually. Yeah, that's, have you, it's funny, so obviously I get this whole sampling thing from two angles, because I'm involved, whilst I don't do direct clearance of that, in my legal capacity, of that many samples, because it's not really proportionate to get a lawyer to do it, it's better to get the record label or somebody else to do it. I deal with samples. Clearance or records involving sample clearance every day of the week, and I've got one at the moment, and there are some of them where you just think there is no way they're going to clear this, and I suppose at this point it's sensible to have like just to give the basics of it, which is that there are two samples that probably need to be cleared. You've got the recording sample and you've got the composition, and the composition needs to be cleared come what may, and the recording, it's a good idea to give it a go. And if you can't, then there's amazing businesses out there who are capable of recreating all but the most difficult to recreate samples. So dealing with the latter point there, which is a way of, if you like, circumventing the need to clear the recording side. Have you dealt in sample with so-called sample replay businesses before?
Yeah, I use a guy called Tyrell a lot, who's an absolute wizard. And I just sent him something from like a rock band recently that he's just completely replayed, like the strings, the saxophone, the electric guitar, and it's so spot on, it's unbelievable. So nowadays it's a lot easier to go down that route of kind of bypassing the need to clear the master, I'll usually get everything replayed and then apply for the publishing side of things, which makes life a lot easier. But saying that, I've found a lot of the major labels nowadays are a lot more up for working on new versions. So if you've got a kind of bootleg or a remix that you've put out or that's kind of been playing out, if the labels hear it, a lot of the times now they'll actually say, hey, let's try and make this official, let's make some money on it, rather than, hey, you shouldn't be doing this, we're going to sue you. So it seems to be a lot more that way now compared to like 5-6 years ago, where, you know, if you did something like that, suddenly you were getting cease and desists and, you know, all kinds of, and letters from people like yourself, Jules.
Yeah. Well, I do the nice side of law. I'm more like a priest than a divorce counsellor. I marry deals, watch them fall apart. It's an interesting one, because, I mean, I guess one could get in deep into the weeds of talking about the creativity of sampling, but I don't think there's any. There was, historically, there was quite a lot of controversy about whether sampling represented creativity or whether it represented just kind of pastiche. And I think everybody accepts that sampling is creative now. I think the shame about everybody kind of being forced to go down the legal path, says the lawyer, is the fact that you can generally only include one big sample in any given record because there's not enough kind of royalties, publishing royalties, to go around. Whereas back in the day, there were artists, I don't know, in the hip-hop world, like De La Soul, who'd have individual tracks that might have 4 or 5 massive samples in one record, because the goalposts were a bit different then. And, you know, ultimately, it is a negotiation. Going back to the basics, and in order to sort of bat it back over to you, Steve, the thing that has to be cleared, whether you like it or not, is the publishing, the songwriting element of a sample, whether or not you choose to invest in replaying it. Have you found, and one thing I've noticed, but I'd rather get your take on it, is that occasionally the songwriter of the original sample can be, or their publisher can be, rather greedy when it comes to how much the original songwriter of the sample gets of the songwriting percentage of your new song that you've created using that sample. Is that a problem that you've encountered?
I have had it where labels, publishers have been kind of greedy or said, all right, yeah, cool, you can put this out, but we want 100% of the publishing, or we want 80% of the publishing. So the labels have the power and the publishers have the power to be able to say, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to put it out or don't you? So unfortunately, yes, I think that's got a little bit more fair these days, just in terms of with a lot of the politics and stuff. I feel that a lot of the publishers are a bit more conscious, and they will also look at, if you're doing these kinds of records, maybe you could be of value to them in the next 2 or 3 years, and maybe they could sign your publishing. So I find that they're a lot more forward thinking these days, whereas in the past, and don't get me wrong, it's still like this as well, where they can kind of think, all right, cool, we've got this, we want to take everything, you know?
So would it be crude to ask, like, what do you think is a fair deal? I guess it obviously depends on what you take and how much of it you use and all those kind of things, but like, just to give, because I think sometimes, like on this podcast, when we talk to people, one of the, I think, good things that comes out of it is sharing this knowledge exchange for people to understand, because lots of people, the first time you get an offer, you don't know if 80% is a good offer or not. So do you have any thoughts on that, like ballpark of what you think is fair, or at least what factors you would take into consideration to be a fair deal?
It's hard, isn't it? Because if I was to sample something really famous, the original artist is going to say, well, people are only into that because of the sample, which there's probably a bit of truth to, but then again, you know, it's a production, and, you know, the whole track and the whole new piece of music that is really effective. So for me, I'd like to say 50-50, but then if the original artist was to say, oh well, look, I want 60% or 75%, I'd probably swallow it, and I would look more forward to, all right, well, this can set up the next record for me to be original, or for me to have more of a publishing cut. So I'd kind of use it as like a stepping stone to be able to build up to the point that I'd want to. But I think being in this industry for so long, I just feel sometimes you just got to swallow it and you just got to say, all right, cool. You know, they have the power, and sometimes it's very hard to get, it's like getting blood out of a stone.
To add a little bit to that, that particular conversation, very often, a lot of major labels, that is the kind of labels of Sony, Universal and Warner, are currently signing many dance records. It's a big kind of commercial moment for dance music. And many of those records do include samples. And my sort of golden rule, wherever possible, for the people I look after, the artists I look after, is by all means, leverage the bargaining power of your major label who wants to sign you to clear the recording side of the sample. But for goodness sake, don't let them give too much of the game away as far as the publishing is concerned. And again, I don't want to get too deep into it, but the reality is your record company has no skin in the game and no concern whether they give away all your publishing on a sample or none of it. They just want to get the bloody record out. So wherever possible, if you've got experience, if you've got a manager, you've got a lawyer, you've got a bit of commercial kind of business knowledge, try and keep a rein on the negotiation regarding the publishing side, because if you let your record company do it for you, they simply, it's just a reality. Why would they care? They just want the record out.
And they want to get it out quickly. So for them, it's a lot easier to register a pay through to, oh yeah, publishing sorted, it's all being paid through, don't worry about anything. So it's very important for artists and musicians as well to be aware of all these things, you know, and to, when they're going into a deal, understand what they're signing, what they're giving away, what they're keeping, and what also they need to sort out. Because, yeah, you're absolutely right. I've had a few majors that have kind of said, oh, we'll just pay that through. And I've kind of been like, whoa, hold on, let me see if we can sort out clearance or some kind of publishing first and register this as a new work. So even if we can only get 10% of publishing, that's still of value to me. It still builds my publishing catalogue and creates an overall value for the future, you know. So, I never try and be too greedy, and often I'm thankful when, you know, big artists or big writers say, all right, cool, you can use this and have some publishing. I always feel very grateful for that. But yeah, I feel it's very important, especially these days, for artists to be aware of stuff like that. Otherwise, you know, you could end up losing out on a lot of money as well.
Yeah, I think looking at it from a practical perspective, especially in electronic music, there are certain producers who treat music making and therefore songwriting as a bit of a loss leader to generate gigs. But the one thing I believe that the pandemic taught us, when all DJs globally lost their live income, at least for a while, is that there is still actually, if you do the right deals, plenty of money to be made out of music making as well. And therefore it's, I believe one of my sort of golden mantras with all artists is to try and, you don't have to be the top dog business person, but you do have to be pretty commercially savvy at the same time. And and I guess that's a question for you, Steve. Have you found by necessity that you've had to sort of brush up on the industry side of things as opposed to being purely a creative and a performer?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I signed a publishing deal with Ultra over lockdown. I suppose I was in quite a good position pre-lockdown, where I could kind of put the records out that I loved, that I was into, and I could gig, and anything beyond that didn't really matter because I was doing what I wanted to do, what I loved, and anything else I wasn't too bothered about. So when all the kind of gigs got taken away and it's like, right, I need to make music for money now, not just because this is what I like and this is what I love to do, I started doing a lot more kind of commercial productions for other artists, songwriting, top lining, which I really enjoyed, and it helped, it benefited my music a lot because it gave me so much more of a kind of scope on working with different people and people from different backgrounds rather than just club people all the time. So I was kind of maybe a bit spoilt before, but whereas since lockdown, I've really kind of almost spread my wings, and I'll do a lot more on the production, remixing, even some tutorial stuff. that has just all been a great benefit for me, you know, and I kind of wish I did it a lot earlier in a sense.
I think in some ways the pandemic did that for a lot of people, didn't it? Because I hate to talk about it like, oh, before the pandemic, everything was fine. And then after we realized this, these income streams of live music and stuff stopped, and therefore we realized we need to make other, I don't think it was quite so rosy. I think there was definitely like a superficial element to that. It's more that like you didn't notice or think about those other types of revenue stream because, you know, you were content with what you could make from the live. But then in many ways, it's really great that, like you said, you've spread your wings and you've learned about other revenue streams, and then hopefully life comes back, but you've still got these additional kind of money-making revenues like ticking over. And I guess that's some of the stuff we talked about in the streaming inquiry, really, because there was an element of like, oh, live's gone, here's a problem, live's back, everything will be fine. So my question is about going back into live after the pandemic. Like, how have you found it? Are things going back to how they were before in terms of doing gigs and stuff, or is there a change?
I think everything's been a lot slower. I don't think there's been as many events. I think people aren't buying tickets like they were. From the feedback and what I've heard from the industry is tickets are just selling a lot slower. So whereas before promoters could put on a rave or an event, things would sell out quite quickly. I think everyone's, that's in a couple of weeks. Let's wait until maybe a week before, then we'll decide or confirm. There still seems to be like a lot of uncertainty. I guess the money side of things as well. Everyone's kind of been hit by that as well from the clubs. So, I mean, a lot of the clubs are trying to charge more now to make back on what they missed out on. Everything's gone up in price. So, you know, and that cost gets, you know, I feel like we take a hit on that as DJs, and also, you know, the punters coming to the event take a hit on that as well. So I definitely wouldn't say everything's back to normal. It kind of feels like a bomb has gone off and there's like a load of debris afterwards. Everyone's like kind of just going through and trying to tidy up. So kind of feels like it's getting there. And then also I found, and I spoke to a lot of other DJs about this as well, like actually playing out. A lot of these like 18, 19 and 20 year olds, say if you're like 20 or 21 now, you've never been to a club. So some of the events I've gone to, like, the kids are just like, what do I do? Do I dance? Like, and everyone just looks a bit like awkward, if that makes sense, because they're not used to it. It's all quite a new experience for them. So that's been kind of weird, I think, for that first generation of kids coming back into like, oh, what is this? What do we do type thing, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Have you had the same kind of experience, Jules?
My market in DJ Solo, what I do, is generally sort of 35 plus, who are certainly more used to what to do on a dance floor. Arguably, I don't know, I probably, in my view, maybe slightly worse affected by the cost of living crisis, because, you know, they've got family, or most of them got families, and slightly more financial responsibilities. But they do know what to do on the dance floor. So, you know, I wouldn't say it's an over difficult time, but it's a more difficult time, that's for sure. But I'm sure that would apply across the entertainment spectrum as well.
Yeah, generally there just seems to be quite a lot of anxiety and quite a lot of uncertainty, even in some of the big promoters that are kind of like, look, you know, they're really struggling to sell those advanced tickets, and a lot of the times just kind of hoping and praying on the night that they're going to be full and they're going to have a good night. So I think once everyone gets their confidence back a little bit from nightclub owners, promoters, I think then there'll be a lot more confidence to say, right, cool, let's put on a lot more parties, if that makes sense.
Yeah, hopefully. So just to steer the conversation back to what we were talking about earlier about the kind of other stuff that you took on, spreading your wings and that kind of thing, and kind of building on what Jules said about having to understand the industry and stuff. Like, how did you, when you said you've been doing some other things, like, do you want to talk a little bit more about what those things are and how you kind of moved into that space?
Yes, I mean, talking to my manager kind of 2 years ago, it's just a question of, right, what do we do now? So we kind of looked at remixes that we could do, and also then working with different artists, collaborations, sessions. So I started kind of talking to a few of the publishers and saying, hey, I'd be up for like doing some work on some of your guys' projects or some more pop stuff. And kind of just got thrown into some Zoom sessions, and I did some stuff with a couple of European artists that was almost like very indie. And I think actually the publishers were really shocked, like, oh wow, okay, this is, I didn't know he could do this. And for me, it was a real novel, fun and new experience where I was like, oh cool, I can make a record like this, great. So I always, it's easier said than done, but I always try and have fun in this industry, and I always try and gravitate towards what I naturally enjoy or what naturally excites me. And then I find the money and success and everything else will come after that. So I just kind of thought, well, let me take some... At first, it was a relief, to be honest with you. When everything stopped and it was like, right, I cannot actually do anything. I was like, whew, okay, cool, I'm going to chill. And I went out, actually, I got a dog, I got some Lego, and just for a week I just sat building Lego and playing with my new dog. And then after that, I kind of thought, well, what do I really want to do? What do I really love? What really interests me? And what, you know, what do I want to achieve? So gave me a bit of time for reflection and then just to explore and to just try different things, which I think is really important, and to find what works, what you're really good at. And I found some of those, and then also what I'm not good at and what I don't like and what I absolutely hate and what I don't want to do, you know? So it gave me a better idea and understanding of the industry as a whole and where I want to be and what I want to do within it as well.
You raise a really interesting point, actually. Forgive me for sort of occasionally bouncing back to the legal theme, but I've always had this, you know, in many respects, being a DJ and being a lawyer are quite different. But actually, obviously, I specialise in music. And the lawyer in me has always said, you know, if you're in, advise your clients, if they're in the studio, they should always, as soon as possible, determine who wrote what in what proportion of any song. The DJ in me, who spent probably in total 2 or 3 years of my life in the studio, has never done that once. I've never once, actually, not even within a month of coming out of the studio, but I ever said, well, I'm on 27% and you're on, you know, 73%. But obviously the law is pretty simple. It's about creative contribution. How on earth do you work that out when you've been doing a Zoom session with somebody? That's my question. How on earth do you want to, I mean, I guess if there's just two of you, it's easy enough, but what happens if there's more of you?
I think if there's three or four, usually most of the sessions I'm in, everything's split equally. Which, you know, sometimes there might be someone in the session that doesn't really contribute that much, but I think it kind of comes around and goes around. So I'm pretty happy to take a split of whoever I'm working with. And, you know, sometimes maybe they might contribute more than me. Sometimes I might put that golden thing in that suddenly makes the track amazing. But for me, it's, especially being around for a while, for me, it's about consistency. And I'm not looking at something as if, oh, this is going to be my big payday. This is going to be the thing that's going to allow me to retire. And I want all of this. And, you know, I tend to just do as much as I can and not really focus on what I'm getting out of it, as long as it's equal to everyone else that's in the room or working on and fair, you know. In that sense,
I'm afraid, as a lawyer, there are many people who don't adopt your mentality. I wish everybody did, because I think that's the right. Well, I totally agree that if one operates on a karma and an aggregate basis, that over the course of a year, you probably did do 50%. Even if on one day you might have done 25%, and another day you did 75% of the work. Sadly, it doesn't always pan out that way, and it's why I've got this kind of juxtaposition between telling people they've got to make these decisions fast on the one hand, on the other hand, knowing that it's just not what goes on in the studio, and it's not really cricket when it comes to the music making process.
I really appreciate your honesty, Jules, about do as I say, not as I do. But maybe then, and also I really, Steve, appreciate what you're saying about, taking an even split, especially if you're working with someone on a regular basis, that kind of makes sense. Maybe it's harder if it's a one-off kind of experience, but I guess question to both of you then is like, what would be a tip if someone was listening to the podcast and they know they've got to have this awkward conversation, like how to approach that?
See, I always go through, I always make sure my management and publishers that I'm working with know before I even go into sessions what I'm kind of expecting. So, you know, before I'll go into, if I'm working with a publisher, I'll say, look, I'm happy to split in the room. So anything I'm a part of, you know, I'm happy to split equally with anyone else that's in the room, so that before I even go into the session, the publisher's aware of that, and that's kind of been agreed with everyone else. So that
tells, and the publisher says that a lot of people don't go in the room.
I mean, you know, I haven't found anyone to be super, super greedy. And I've worked with like Grammy nominated singer songwriters that have been fine splitting, and I kind of find the more professional they are, the more they're like, yeah, cool. If that makes sense.
Yes, I think that's true. I think you're managed. Yeah. I mean, I guess the generic advice that, and again, that kind of clash between the way I've behaved and what I would advise, more relates to people who aren't managed. Because it's very easy if you're managed. You know, what is one of the functions of having a lawyer or having a manager or having both is to get those individuals to say the stuff, the nasty stuff or the nastier stuff that you don't want to say yourself. So it's a lot easier if you've got, or a publisher, I should add to that list. It's more difficult if you're an unmanaged, unpublished, unlawyered artist going into the studio with somebody of a similar ilk to ever have that conversation. And it's those sort of scenarios, which of course does account for a lot of songwriting sessions, where the problems in it often arise.
Yeah, I think it's hard. And I think that in a lot of situations, it can be an unfair industry, you know, and you can end up in a room with someone that can say, right, I want 80% of this, otherwise, and it gets to the point where you think, well, I kind of need this, I need this record, I need the credits and the exposure, so, you know, I'm going to swallow it. And, you know, looking back at a lot of people that I've aspired to or loved or that have influenced me have all been hugely ripped off, you know, from doing remixes for $500 that suddenly are worldwide number ones and all they got was $500, to being featured on a track, getting paid a couple of $100, signing off on it, and then suddenly the track's absolutely huge and they saw nothing. So, but after, you know, when you speak to some of those artists and say, you know, how did you feel about it, a lot of them have kind of said, well, if it wasn't for that record, I wouldn't have a career. So after hearing that as well, sometimes I'm like, sometimes I'll just swallow it and think, all right, cool. I wanted 50%. I'm only getting 30, but let me leverage this to be able to make sure in the next session I can go in at 50 because I've done X, Y, and Z. Do you see what I mean? So sometimes I feel like, it's not fair, but you kind of almost have to build up to that point.
And I suppose building up to the point where you get a manager to do that stuff for you, because in my experience, again, slight tangent, but in my experience, the best managers are those who sort of find the artist in a sort of organic way, as opposed to artists desperately going out and trying to find management, considering them to be the sort of, I don't know, the golden ticket to success. And when that relationship between management and artist occurs on a sort of organic basis, then it genuinely is a lot easier for the manager to go away and say the right stuff and not rub people up the wrong way, but still be relatively sort of hard where they need to be hard.
Yeah. I mean, I find this with a lot of artists and even friends and stuff that will say to me, oh, if only I had an agent, then I'd have bookings. And I always say to them, you've got to do it yourself. You won't get an agent until you start playing out. You won't start playing out until you physically go and start knocking on club doors or networking or speaking to promoters or going to events and putting yourself out there. And then once you start getting a bit of traction or maybe doing a couple of bookings for free, then that might suddenly attract the manager. And I guess it's to say, you know, you could use the same methods in regards to publishing and records that, all right, cool, I'll give away a load of publishing on this or a load of the points on the master just to get this over the line, because then maybe I'll attract someone that can then help me to get into an even better position. But I think a lot of artists come in and they, you know, even some of my friends will go, oh, it's all right for you, you've got a manager, you've got an agent. And but I've had to build to that point, if that makes sense. And I think that's very, very important.
I started as an illegal raid promoter. So, as somebody started life as an illegal raid promoter, I can completely empathise. Yeah, that's one way of doing it. Well, you don't all have to do that, kids.
Yeah. And now you're on the right side of the law, Jules.
I am.
Well, I think this is the thing. Like, all of the people that we talk to is that your journey is, everybody's journey is different. And it's really good to hear, you know, reflections on how you got there's, but one thing that's definitely sure is that there's no overnight successes, and everybody built up to where they are in their own way. But yeah, we are coming to time, so I just wondered if you wanted to tell us, Steve, before you go, what's coming next. Sounds like you've been working on some exciting projects recently.
Yeah, working on loads of music. I've been working on loads of stuff for other artists, which is really, really interesting. And then going into next year, I've got loads of records there for myself. I'm just deciding whether I want to go into another major label deal or not. So
it's a tough life.
Yeah, so like loads of things happening on the gig front going into next year, loads of international tours planned and some really interesting things. I just want to make sure that the records are with the right people and in the right homes going forward, you know. So I'm just spending a lot of time on that just to get that exactly how I want it and on my terms, which I've kind of had to hold off for. And it all looks good, but it's a process, you know.
Well, sounds like some really exciting stuff, so we'll watch this space.
You'll definitely be hearing some new music from me. I'm just not sure where from yet.
Steve, it's been a great pleasure. I'll certainly look out for all of it in my DJ capacity. Thank you so much. Really interesting, great take on a lot of areas of the industry that people are very interested in.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe.